This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. In last week's edition, we spoke to singer, songwriter and theatre maker Corinne Polwart about some of the places that she finds inspirational for her work. I'd like to continue that conversation now and talk about a wonderful project she was involved with called Spell Songs. The initial idea for that came from a writer that my colleague Helen Needham really admires.
I am a huge fan of Robert McFarlane. I remember when I first came across his writing a few years ago, I felt like an epiphany because he was describing, just so poetically, the things that I actually love and care about. One of his works, The Lost Words, is a book he did with the visual artist Jackie Morris, where they took words from the natural world which are falling out of common usage, especially among children, words like conquer and kingfisher. And you had the good fortune to be involved in the musical manifestation of that project.
Yeah, that was such a beautiful project to be involved in. So Robert and Jackie are both big music fans, and they worked in collaboration with an organisation called Folk by the Oak, which is an English folk festival, to bring together 8 writers and musicians in a residency. This was at the beginning of last year. So they include folks that would be well known to a Scottish audience, Julie Fowlis, Chris Drever, but also the Senegalese kora player and composer Sekou Keita. 8 of us all together for a week to respond to this book. The Lost Words includes 20 words that were falling out of use. In fact, they had been excised from one of the major children's dictionaries. That was what sparked the project, was just how can it be that words like, I mean, for me, heron and wren and willow, they're so familiar to me in this place. How can they be falling out of children's dictionaries? So we were given free rein by Jackie and Robert as the creators of that book to respond however we wanted to. And the project is called Spell Songs. And, it's been an absolute delight to be involved in that project. It's one of the most genuinely collaborative. Yeah, I felt like I've joined a new band by accident, and I think some of the stuff that we've created is really very, very beautiful, and I think it's generated some of the kind of most heartfelt feedback from people that I've ever had for any project that I've been involved in.
This podcast isn't about us, but I'm going to reference myself for this because I listened to your music this morning. You wrote a blessing for Lost Words. I've had for the last 3 or 4 weeks actually quite I'm up against a deadline, you know, and I'm trying to get something finished and I'm working hard on it, etc. And it's occupying damn near every moment of my day. And I listened to that piece of music and I suddenly found myself crying. And it was a release, pure and simple, and I felt so much better afterwards.
I I cried as well when I would listen to it again yesterday.
Oh, no.
Because I've listened to
a pair of saps we are.
I know. Well, it just shows our soft hearts.
That's
doesn't
a folk singer's job. That's it. If you've made somebody cry, you've done the job.
Yeah, but I've listened to the album a lot because I've played it a lot on BBC Radio Scotland's Travelling Folk. So I have heard it before, but for some reason it just struck me yesterday. It just, whoo! I think it's the context of the world that we're living in at the moment as well. It seemed to take on new meaning.
Enter the wild with care, my love, and speak the things you see. Let new names take and root and thrive and grow. And even as you travel far from heather, crag and river, may you like the little fisher set the stream alight with glitter. May you enter now as otter without falter into water.
The way that The Lost Words is conceived is that the words in the book, which are written by Robert, are all written in the form of spells. So they're very dynamic and visual, and there's lots and lots of imagery. You can see lots of stuff. And when I was reading through all of these spells, I was reminded of one of my favourite folk collections is Carmina Gadelica, which is a Gaelic collection of spells, incantations, charms, and it's gorgeous. I mean, I don't understand the Gaelic, but the translations into English are absolutely beautiful. And what struck me was that loads of these charms and incantations and lullabies were rich with natural imagery. So I suggested to the group that we might write a blessing that brought in a number of Robert's different spells into one piece. In my head, with the Carmina Gadelica and Gaelic kind of incantation form.
And even as you journey on, past dying stars exploding, like the gilded one in flight, leave your little gifts of light, and in the dead of night, my darling, find the gleaming eye of starling, like the little aviator, sing your heart to all dark matter.
So it's sort of like a litany of the creatures that appear in The Lost Words, and because so many of us involved in the residency are parents, we were really in the mode of thinking about the impact of losing these words and what that means for the future of our own children. So it's effectively a blessing come lullaby for the generations to come.
Walk through the world with care, my love, and sing the things you see. Let new names take and root and thrive and grow. And even as you stumble through Macher sands eroding,
Jackie Morris depicted all the artists as animals in her drawings accompanying the album, and she made you the wren. Why?
Oh, I was so chuffed that she made me the wren. I think I love wrens. I've written about wrens. I have a song called King of Birds that's in praise of wrens and the whole legend of the King of Birds in myth and folklore in Scotland and across Europe and North Africa. The wren is the King of Birds. It's a story about small power. But I think how Jackie put it was, she said, I was wee but feisty, I think she said. And I thought, you know what, I'll take that. Because for me, I love wrens and they are quite elusive, but my goodness, they can make a racket and will stand up for themselves. And, if you're going to be the human embodiment of some creature, I'll have the wren.
We spoke recently to a lady called Esther Wolfson on this podcast about a book that she'd just written about her relationship with animals. The whole point of lost words is the fact that certain words are falling out of common usage, incredibly. But, you know, the relationship we've had has changed so enormously over the years.
I think there are very different relationships according to where you live and what access you have to land around you. And actually, I think that's a thing that's become very, very clear during the lockdown period, is the inequality of all of that. So I live here in a village of 1,000 people. At no point during lockdown was I unable to get outside and enjoy what's around me. I can walk within a matter of minutes into fields, woodland, very close to me, moors and hills. So I was never deprived of connection with birds and life. But if you're living in a tenement flat, in a city, and your local park is shut off, and in order to get anywhere you have to pass through great throngs of other people, you're inevitably your connection to other living beings and is not the same. So I think there's a tremendous inequality about that relationship and who has access to it and who doesn't. And I think that's become an issue of social justice in the past few months, as well as an issue of environmental urgency. It's about human well-being as well as about the well-being of the environment that we live in.
The live programme that we do for BBC Radio Scotland Out of Doors, right at the beginning of lockdown, we said, you know, people can't go into the natural world anymore, but, you know, we have to do our level best to try and bring the natural world to them. And we're all lucky. I mean, Helen lives in the country, I live in the country, Ewan lives in the country. You know, we could do that. But it was such a fine line to walk between saying, look, this is fabulous and it's still here and it's still going on, and potentially rubbing somebody's nose in it.
I think that's true. And I think it does require you to a bit of humility about the advantages that you have. And actually, when you have those advantages, which I very much do, living where I live, to absolutely relish them. Do you know what I mean? Cherish them, is, I guess, would be the word. I mean, and not take them for granted, because they're not. That's not something that everyone can enjoy, but it's something that everyone should enjoy. And actually, if we want to kind of look after this place that we live in, people need to care. And that was one of the things about the lost words, was the whole idea that if you don't have the words for the creatures and the plants that you live around, it's not possible to love those things. So to name a thing and to connect with it is the beginning of a journey into caring about that animal or that tree. So it matters. Language matters. When you don't have the language for things, you don't notice those things and you don't care for them. So it's all bound up together. And I think that's where art and music and literature and radio, you know, has a really important role to play. We want the stories of connection as much as we need the actual bodily connection. The story of connection is important too.
There's a particular animal that actually maybe not that many people get the chance to see, but I've had amazing encounters with mountain hares. Such beautiful creatures, but in a fragile state, really. You wrote about the mountain hare as part of this project.
The hare turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the rain is falling. The hare turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the dark is rising. By the loch of the birds he hunkers down in the heather. He waits for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
I wrote a song with Julie Fowlis, which was a complete treat. She's been a friend for a number of years, but we've never had the chance to work together in any close way. And in the Lost Words book, one of the first animals that you see as you turn the pages of the book, and to give you a sense of the book is a huge format book, so the visual images are very lush. Robert McFarlane himself is the snow hare, the mountain hare, in the book. That's how Jackie Morris envisages Robert McFarlane. So he is the hare. Julie was remembering the last time that she had seen a mountain hare out walking. we began to look at the maps and the names for the places where Julie had seen the mountain hare, and to realise that many of the places, I can't say them in Gaelic, unfortunately, that a lot of the names reveal the creatures that live there. The cairn of the stag, the loch of the birds, you know, loads of old names have got information in them about what's alive in those places.
The snow hare hides in the mountain moss. Oh, the sleet is falling. The snow hare hides in the mountain moss. Oh, the dark is rising. By the cairn of the goose, he hunkers down in the heather. He longs for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
I guess there are a number of different vulnerabilities about the hare. It's a very contested creature right now in terms of what our moorland landscapes are for. There's a piece of legislation gone through recently to ban the culling of mountain hares. The theory is to reduce ticks, but actually it's to do with the economics of shooting and hunting. So I'm glad to see that there's a move towards protecting that species. It's also a species which is inevitably going to become more and more vulnerable because it's an animal that's evolved to turn white in the winter in response to snowy conditions. And as climate change ramps up, that doesn't happen. And it's a big issue, I know, for the snowshoe hare over in North America, is that the animals continue to change. They continue to change coat, but the landscape around them doesn't change. And if you're a white animal in a landscape that's no longer white, then you are extremely vulnerable.
He prays for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
One of the joys, I think, of our job is meeting people who observe the world in a different way. So I love talking to geologists because they look at the world, you know, completely differently. They see things that I don't see. Or archaeologists do the same thing. Or I was talking to a moth man just a couple of days ago, you know, who's talking about seeing thousands of moths migrating onto the coastline not far from here. And I thought, I've never seen... I mean, I consider myself to be reasonably observant, but I have never seen thousands of moths. He obviously just had the eye for it. Years ago, I spoke to a guy called G.F. Dutton, who had a real feeling for trees. He seemed to have an almost supernatural ability to define whether they were healthy, unhealthy, what was going on with them, what they needed, whether they were in the right place, that kind of thing. You have a lovely track called Heartwood, which is written from a tree's perspective. And it's just, it's one of those things that just shines a light on the world in a slightly different way.
Yeah, well, the Heartwood piece is one of Robert's spells from a follow-up project that Robert and Jackie have made to The Lost Words. And it includes a spell for a tree, and it includes a spell for the snow hare. And in fact, it includes a spell for moths as well in the one that's to come. And that piece is written from the point of view of a tree which is about to be felled. And the spur, I think, for that spell was a whole bunch of controversy in recent years in the city of Sheffield. And the city council gave the contract out to manage the local trees to a private company. And thousands of trees were cut down in the city, and it caused a public uproar, which has actually come to, I think, a good place in the past year or so. There's been a change of policy now in the city around the cutting down of trees. But there's something beautiful about assuming the voice of a non-human entity. So much like the way that I became the rock of the island of Lewis to talk to Donald Trump, if you put yourself in the position of the tree, it can just subtly alter how you view the tree.
Would you hew me to the heartwood cutter? Would you lay me low beneath your feet? Listen to my sad mutter. Hear my heart. Throw me on the log pile cutter.
And I think because there's been so much amazing science and writing in recent years Around Trees, you have Richard Powers' The Overstory winning the Pulitzer Prize, and all the kind of science that's become public discourse, I think, over the past couple of years around the complexity of trees and how they communicate with one another and how much is going on underneath the ground that we can't see. But basically, you know, the communicative, almost empathetic, or at least trees as a team species, trees working together across, again, stretches of time that we find it difficult to conceive of as human beings. And I think maybe that science is altering how we view trees and how we look after them. So the Heartwood piece speaks to that.
I drink the rain, I eat the sun, I give the breath that fills your lungs, I hear the roaring engines thrum, but I cannot run. Would you hew me to the heartwood cutter?
You mentioned in Sheffield how the community actually got together and managed to change the policy. This is a theme that runs through a new essay that you've written for a wonderful collection of Scottish nature writing, which has been put together by Kathleen Jamie. We just spoke to her quite recently on this podcast, Antlers of Water. You chose to write your essay inspired by Inga Thompson. She's a friend of yours and a musician who comes from Fair Isle. And Fair Isle, that lies between Shetland and Orkney. Just tell us a bit about this particular project.
Well, Inga is my dear friend. I can actually see the back door of her house from the window that I'm looking out right now. She's from Fair Isle and grew up there, and her extended family still live there. She lives now in my village in Pathhead, and she's my regular bandmate in my trio and a really good friend. And a few years ago, she made a project called Deficient Hands, which she was making with her cousin, who was called Lisa Sinclair, a fantastic poet and musician, also from Fair Isle. And the piece was connected to a campaign in Fair Isle over many years to have the island recognised as a marine protectorate. And the Fishing Hands, to let you understand, are the spawning grounds, and they're basically instructions for where you can fish and where fish are spawning. They're sort of visual coordinates to let you understand where to go for certain things. And basically you can map the landscape from sea level, as if you were in a boat and heading out to fish, from one cliff point to, say, a house on the mainland, and in between these points is where you'll find the mackerel, that kind of thing. So it's like a sort of oral map of the waters around the isle. And it's been passed from generation to generation. It formed the basis of a campaign in Fair Isle to have a 5-mile zone around the isle protected from overfishing. It's been a massively contested issue in Shetland waters, the issue of who has access to the waters and what those waters are for. So there was an organisation on Fair Isle called FIMETI, which was an island-wide, unanimously backed organisation campaigning for marine protectorate status. And Inga's work with her cousin Lisa was a musical, artistic response to that.
We stipple the sky, a snowstorm of angels deceiving my eye. You've left me before. Something's gone, something's lost, something's broken.
One of the most beautiful tracks on it, it's about the kittiwakes. It's not just about the fish around the isle, it's about the nesting seabirds as well, and the massive reduction in numbers of seabirds on the island, the most notable of which is the kittiwakes, because they used to be huge, vast clouds of kittiwakes. One of the greatest impacts is on the sound and just the diminishment of sound.
Mm-hmm.
were you seeing here? It's just the same snow globe, but the bubble's gone dry. We'll wait for the bird's response to the sky, an island of ice with a careful gauge. 420 years or more.
There are things that music and poetry and art can say much more effectively than scientific papers can. So I think there's a really positive trend, I think, in recent years towards collaborations between scientists and artists. And Inga worked really closely with the Bird Observatory on Fair Isle. I think it's just a gorgeous project. And the whole campaign worked. That's the punchline to it all, is that Fair Isle now has secured a degree of protection for a radius around the isle, and that's really due to the sustained hard efforts of the islanders themselves.
I walked out of the house this morning before the rain came on, and there were probably about 100 starlings on the power lines which run up the hill from us, and it looked like notes on a musical stave. Now, I am not a musician and I can't read music, but you write in this essay about how Inga, and you explain this to me, because effectively what she did was she took these fishing hands, what in other areas are called fishing tails, where they take these marks and triangulate it, you know, and you can, out at sea, you can tell exactly where you are by lining up landmarks and things. What did she do? Because she did something really clever, but I couldn't follow it.
As a visual representation, what do fishing hands look like? Is they look like very angular shards, these really, really sharp triangular shards that kind of almost look like an explosion.
Or a sunburst or something, yeah, okay.
Or a sunburst, so it's very, very jaggy. And what Inga did was she took these shards and she effectively imagined that they were made in string. And then she stretched the string as if it were horizontal. So she turned the scatter pattern into like a hilly landscape, sort of like a land scheme. What she also did was she took data from the Bird Observatory about the rise and fall, in particular of kittiwake numbers, which would appear as a graph. And imagine that graph as if it were the rise and fall of musical notes. So she had these different resources that create a topography, basically, along a horizontal line. And that's what music is. If you join the line between musical notes on a stave, it's also effectively like a horizon line. So she constructed pieces of music from scientific data and from the visual representation of deficient hands. And the process is, it's called a visual score, where you take non-musical information and use it as a way to conjure music. What she also said was that a lot of the tunes that were generated by that process were torture to listen to if you went on for too long because they were really, really spiky and jaggy. But she's got these little bits and pieces of music that have been, they've come from that process. And she also has pieces of music that have come from listening to voices, because all voices are musical, but the voices of Fair Islanders are particularly musical. Some of the tunes are also inspired by the rise and fall, the cadence of people's voices that she spoke to and that Lisa spoke to in the course of making the piece. So it's kind of lovely. There's these two ways to create these little musical topographies. One is the landscape and one is the sound of people. And then you have this element of scientific data into the pot as well. So she drew on all these resources, and it's really a gorgeous piece of work. I would urge people to go and have a listen to Fishing Hands, but my favourite piece from it is called Snowstorm, and it's an elegy to the loss of the kittiwakes.
Something's gone, something's lost, something's broken. Something's gone, something's lost, something's broken. Something's gone, something's lost, something's broken.
We've touched on this already, but you quote Inga talking about how artists can have a catalytic role to play in wider situations of human-animal conflict or environmental dispute. The fact that having dialogue within this context means you can go deeper, and there's an element of trust there. You know, instead of a scientist maybe going and asking someone to fill out a form, it's sitting down face-to-face, side-by-side, having a conversation. Does that sentiment chime with you and what you're trying to do with your work?
Yeah, very much so. I think there's a humanity involved and a personal connection involved. Well, I mean, the process through which Inga made that work was literally knee-to-knee. It was about listening to people who might not want to engage with more formal public processes. I think as people, we need different ways to connect with the issues that are around us. Some people are great at public campaigning and filling in forms, and there are more and less mechanistic ways of trying to find out what matters to people. But listening is really important, and making space to listen to what one person says can have a really transformative impact, I think. It's also an amazing resource as a writer or maker of stuff. People's stories are gold dust. To me, I have got nothing to say without the stories of other people. I'm not particularly interested in the interior workings of my own head. And as a musician that's come from the folk tradition, to me, that's what the whole thing is about. It's about having your ear to the ground, like what is happening and the way that people say things and the things that other people notice. So even when your name is stamped on a piece of work as an individual writer or maker, to me, it's essentially collaborative. I'm a constant fisher after stories and pinching people's lines and ways of saying things. And I'm constantly being gifted ideas for things to write about and things to investigate. And you can only be gifted those things if you're essentially interested in what other people have to say. And I am interested in what other people have to say. So it's not just that the landscape around me is a massive resource to write about. The people around me and their connection with the landscape is another resource all of its own.
There's no Edinburgh International Festival this year or the Fringe or anything else for obvious reasons. But this time last year I was down for the Fringe and I went to the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh, and there was a beautiful, I mean really beautiful, outdoor exhibition on there about the sounds of the Flow Country. Now, the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh celebrate 350th anniversary this year, and you are currently artist in residence.
Yeah, I'm working with Pippa Murphy, with whom I made Wind Resistance. We are jointly commissioned as artists in residence for the Botanic Garden. We actually had a piece in the Flow Country exhibition last year, one of the pieces from Wind Resistance. Anyway, it's a total treat because it's the 350th anniversary of the Botanic Garden. We are the first musicians, I think, that they've ever commissioned as artists, because until now, all the commissioned artists, I think, have been visual artists. Christine Borland is also commissioned as part of the 350th anniversary, and the Botanics have also just announced in the past couple of weeks that they're moving all their exhibits towards a model of, they're calling it Climate House, where essentially all the work that they commission and exhibit now has to be rooted in the ethos of the garden itself. And that's a massive change for the Botanics, because it used to be that many of the exhibits were very beautiful art exhibitions, but they had no essential connection with the work that actually is undertaken in the garden and what the garden represents. Part of the appeal of that commission was that we would have a chance to work side by side with the many, many scientists. There's a huge scientific team behind the scenes at the Botanics, glasshouses that the public generally don't get access to, really important international research. Also, we would have a chance to delve around in their archive, which is extraordinary, and the herbarium, which is an absolute, just what a resource, which is essentially a library of plants, real plants pressed in huge, beautiful books. So part of the appeal was that it would be tactile and we would literally be in about the scientists, and we haven't been able to do that. So I think we're just waiting. I'm actually going this afternoon for the first time to the Botanics since lockdown happened. I've booked my ticket, and Pippa and I are going to have a wander around the garden, and have a cup of coffee with one of the art directors there and just talk about how it is that we start to engage practically with that. But I'm very excited about that prospect. The exhibition will now happen next year. But yeah, it's such a gift because I love the Botanic Garden. It's a beautiful place and fascinating.
It's not just the garden you haven't been able to go to, or the scientist visit and that kind of thing. Everywhere pretty well has been out of bounds. What does that mean for a jobbing musician? You know, because you're used to touring, taking stuff out.
Well, I mean, I can't really overstate the impact on musicians and live performers of all kinds. It's a decimation of work, to be frank. I've lost 80% of my work this year, and it's unlikely that that work is going to resume in anything like the previous form till the summer of next year. So it's really quite a profound impact, and loads of my pals and peers are having a really, really tough time. It's tough financially. It's also tough in terms of your identity, that if a large part of what you do is about convening with people in public spaces and you can't do that. I had a real proper meltdown 2 or 3 months ago where I just didn't know what I didn't know what the point of me was.
I get that most Tuesdays.
But it was a real feeling of like, oh my goodness, what am I? What am I if I can't be in these spaces? And the way that I've got round it is very, very modest, but I've done a couple of really tiny back garden gigs for folks that neighbours or colleagues in the area who've been stuck at home or who are not well. And I've really enjoyed just having something to do and something meaningful. But they've been tiny, bespoke, curated backyard, socially distanced gigs for one household, which is not a sustainable financial model for being a musician. But it does make me feel again like I've got purpose. But really, it's a very, very difficult time. And musicians and artists and performers of all kinds are generally really struggling and having to think sideways about how to make work and how to have it reach people. So I don't have a solution to that as the honest truth, but for now I'm managing to pay my bills with thanks to organisations like the Botanic Gardens that have offered commissioned work. And that's the difference, I think, for me, that's allowing me to float and feel like I have some use in this world. There's one thing I would love to say about the Botanic Garden that feels really symbolic right now, because the garden was set up in 1670, 15 years after a massive plague outbreak in Edinburgh. And the founders of the garden set it up explicitly in response to the fact that there had been this huge epidemic in the city that had killed, I think, a quarter of Edinburgh's population. It's kind of mind-blowing to conceive of it. And the garden was set up as a civic resource, the idea being that they would gather plants from Scotland and from around the world and build a garden as a health resource for the people of Edinburgh and the people of Scotland. And there's something beautiful about where science and compassion meet. I think that's written into the history of the Botanic Garden, and I think now it's such an important place in the city for people to go and feel better and be amongst these beautiful trees and plants. That whole issue of well-being and something being a public resource as well as a scientific institution, I'm really fascinated by how those things are mixed up together, and really excited about making something, given that I think the time we are in has a lot of ripple connections with the time in which the garden was established.
Oh, well said. Corinne, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I was looking forward to it, and it hasn't disappointed. Thanks again. That's wonderful.
Oh, thanks a lot. Cheers. Take care.
No bother at all. You can find out more information about Corinne and all her work on our website, corinnepolwart.com. That's all one word, Corinne Polwart. Get in touch with us. Please tell us what you think of this podcast. You can rate us or like us or whatever, because apparently it means more people might get a chance to hear it, which is a good thing. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham and Corinne Polwart, thanks for listening.
Adelagate Hill, smoke and mirrors bruise the sky. The pilgrims huddle in as the tiny king of birds begins to cry. The people start to sing to light glory in the dark, to ring the bell and to breathe hope in every heart.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.